Today we're going to begin a couple weeks on the book of Daniel, and today I want to look at Daniel's personal life, and so that means we sort of have to survey the entire book of Daniel to get a glimpse of what it was like to be that person at that time and in that place. And you know, it's a great thing. I was talking to somebody recently again about the accusation that Christians are anti-Semitic, and I was reminded again of Daniel. Daniel is such a great person. Far from being anti-Semitic, we Christians know more about people like Daniel and David and Joseph, Jewish people, than we know about the presidents of the United States. We can go to our Sunday school kids and say, okay, tell us everything you know about George Washington. And they know far more about David and Daniel and Joseph than they know about George Washington. So there certainly is no issue with anti-Semitism in a solidly biblical community. We love these fellows. All of our heroes are Jewish. And of course, our Savior himself is Jewish. But of all the Jewish people, maybe Daniel is the best loved because he is the fellow who is the great prophet. He went in the lion's den. As a young man, he stood firm. He's great. I would be very, very sorry for my sons to turn out like David. I don't want my sons to be David. That would be awful. It would be one of the greatest disappointments in my life for my son to be like David. I certainly don't want my sons to be like Samson or most of the kings of the Old Testament, any of the kings of the Old Testament times. I would like my sons to be Joseph, Daniel, and not very many other Old Testament figures. Well, Daniel's the best of the best. We love Daniel. So I want to give you a glimpse of what it was like to be Daniel, and particularly because he was such a young man when he had to be so strong. So look at some of the bulleted points I have there at the very top of that page, page 171 in your notes. Since 721, sometimes we say 722, there's a little fudging on these dates. We're not 100% sure of how certain of these things should be dated. But about 721 BC, Judah has been the only kingdom because in 722 or 721, the 10 northern tribes went into captivity in Samaria. And that left us only with the two southern tribes, the nation that we call Judah. So this is the last. This is the remnant. Only two tribes left. Then you see the second bullet down. The real trouble begins in 609 because the two southern tribes, the nation of Judah, have a good king over them, good king Josiah. Josiah goes to battle unnecessarily against the Egyptians who were just passing through. He shouldn't have done that. But good king Josiah went out and he battled those people and he died unnecessarily. Well, once Egypt beat down good king Josiah and his army, there was nothing keeping them from taking control over Jerusalem, and they did. So the next king of Judah is appointed by Egyptians. The Egyptians are in charge. So 609, you have Egypt calling the shots. There still is a king, but the king is under the Egyptian king. And so you know where you stand. That's 609. Well, in 606, that's not very long after 609, right? We're coming forward in time, just 3 years. In 606, Babylon has taken control of Jerusalem from Egypt. Egypt's not in control anymore because Egypt lost to Babylon. Now Babylon's in control. And Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar in particular, decides to haul Daniel off into captivity. So 609, that was a very bad year because that's when the Egyptians took control of Jerusalem. 606 or 605, depending which dates we're using, that's a very bad year because now Daniel has to go into captivity. And what really took place is that a handful of the royals were carried off into captivity. Daniel was a very important part of the aristocracy. So off he goes to Babylon and he's in captivity. And he must have been just a kid. You see the heading where it says Daniel made a lifetime home in Babylon. He really is going to be there all of his life for all intents and purposes. We know he lived in Babylon not less than 70 years. So that's in Babylon, 70 years. He must have been very young, therefore, when he got deported, captured, and brought to Babylon. He must have been in his teen years. And you look in the italics there, I've given you the arithmetic. If he goes into Babylon in the third year of Jehoiakim, that should be about 606, maybe 605, whichever. Then he lives until the reign of Cyrus, actually well into the reign of Cyrus. So Cyrus is 536 beginning. So he has to be from 606 to 536. That's 70 years. That's 70 years in Babylon. So you can't imagine that he would be 30 years old when he went to Babylon. That'd make him 100 years old. That's not likely. He would have been a kid, a teenager. All right, so you see the next heading there. Daniel's first test of loyalty to God must have come then when he was just a teenager in his teen years. And that's what we read about in chapter 1. I might reference some of these verses. I couldn't possibly write down all the verses that I referenced here, and we don't have to turn to them all either. But some of these you should notice. You see the first bullet. In order to make peace with the Jewish people, Nebuchadnezzar determined to take the best Jewish captives and make them into leaders. So you can imagine if you are a Jewish person in Babylon and you resent being captured, naturally you would. What if somebody grabbed your family and took you off to China? You might not want to be in China. Well, that's what Nebuchadnezzar did. But to make amends, to make things up to the people, he decided to take some of their best prospects and educate them for leadership in Babylon. And Daniel was among those best prospects. You can see in verse 3 of chapter 1, the king spoke unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes. And so Daniel was castrated, made a eunuch. He was given a pagan name in verses 6 and 7. Now, these were the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. We know Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah primarily as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, mentioned in verse 7. Daniel's Babylonian name was Belteshazzar, and so he was given a pagan name, as were Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So castrated, given a pagan name, then they're trained in all the occult sciences of Babylon. So in verse 4, these were young individuals in whom was no blemish, very handsome, well-favored, skillful in wisdom, cunning in knowledge, understanding science, such as the ability to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the language of the Chaldeans. Well, the Chaldeans' learning and language was mainly in the occult sciences, not exclusively, but mainly in the occult sciences, astrology, that sort of thing, the occult arts. And so Daniel has to learn pagan ways. That's what Nebuchadnezzar is teaching. That was the intention. Well, so you see the second bullet there. Daniel determined that he would not eat the food that was offered in verse 5. And he requested that he would have a 10-day test diet of kosher vegetables. And that's described verses 9 through 17. So the idea is that Nebuchadnezzar is going to make good Babylonian kids out of these Jewish boys. And Daniel says, well, one thing we cannot help you with is this diet in Babylon. You are not preparing your food according to the Old Testament law, and your food is always being blessed by pagans, and so we can't eat it. What we will do, if it's okay, is eat just kosher vegetables for 10 days and see how we do. Well, they passed that test. Having had the kosher vegetables, they looked as fit and trim and muscular as the fellows who were having the king's rich meats and protein diet. And so then part two of that was that they were allowed to pursue a 3-year diet program of kosher vegetables. And that worked out by God's grace. Normally, you're not going to be robust with just vegetables, but it was okay in this instance, and Daniel and his friends did very well. The main thing, of course, is that this was a test of loyalty. So look at chapter 1, verse 17. And for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill and all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And at the end of the days that the king said that he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in to Nebuchadnezzar, and the king communed with them. And among them was found none like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were the best, the most handsome, fairer and fatter in flesh. And so they did just fine on their kosher diet. And all this was the blessing of God. It wouldn't have worked without the blessing of God. Well, so Daniel's just a kid, and he has to take a stand. What was he? Maybe 14 years old. And he says, no, I'm going to do the right thing. Dare to be a Daniel. That was great. Well, his first test as a prophet of God comes in chapter 2. And it is a big test. And he is apparently still in the same year that he arrived in Babylon. So he's 14 or 15 years old. And he has to be tested now as a prophet of God. And so you see the points that we have there. When the occult practitioners fail to reveal either the king's dream or its meaning. This is the dream about the image of Nebuchadnezzar. And the rock comes from the mountain, hewn out without hands, blasts against the statue and shatters it and blows the dust away. And the rock grows into a mountain, which represents the kingdom of God covering the whole world. Well, when Nebuchadnezzar dreamed that dream, nobody could say what the dream was or what it meant, but Daniel was called on to do it. The king was determined to kill all the wise men. If they can't interpret the dream, then what good are they? He's going to kill them all. Daniel asked for time to consider what was being requested. If you look at chapter 2, verse 16, then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. And so he asked for extra time. He is granted extra time. And then we see he rallies prayer support in verses 17 and 18. The first thing he does, he runs over to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He says, the text says, then Daniel went to his house. He made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning the secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And as it turns out, of course, God gives him the answer to that prayer, and he's able to tell the king his dream. Again, the beauty of this is Daniel's just a kid. He's a child. He's 14, 15 years old, and he stands fast, and he knows exactly what to do. He's going to be a praying young man, and he does a beautiful job. In chapter 4, there's another test. I'm not going to show you that right now, but this is yet another dream that needs to be interpreted. This is the dream where Nebuchadnezzar is told that he's going to lose his sanity. This is the cutting the tree down vision, and the stump is retained, and 7 years passes over, and then the stump sprouts and is restored. Well, this tree vision was the same kind of thing as chapter 2, and Daniel has to give the interpretation, which he does. What's really interesting now, we're going to go into time such a long ways. Chapter 4 might have been somewhat early in Daniel's life, but chapter 5, we're getting to Daniel as a very old man. We're at least now in the year 538, so 68 years after Daniel's arrival in Babylon. But he's not 68 years old because he didn't come to Babylon when he was a little baby. He came to Babylon when he was a teenager. So what must he really be? 68 plus 14, maybe plus 15, we don't know. But he's not a kid. He's up in years. And in chapter 5, we have the Feast of Belshazzar. You notice the difference. Daniel's pagan name is Belteshazzar. This king is Belshazzar. So almost the same, but you notice the extra syllable. This is the Feast of Belshazzar, where there's handwriting on the wall. And you remember the feast is interrupted by God's handwriting on the wall. Daniel is called in to explain the meaning of the handwriting. They can read the words just fine. The problem is not in reading the words. It's in understanding the implications. What does it mean to me that on the wall it says numbered, weighed, wanting? What is that supposed to mean? They don't know what it means. So Daniel is called in to say what it means. Daniel's been so neglected over this time. You see in chapter 5, about verse 17, the new king, Belshazzar, who's really the third since Daniel came to Babylon, first was Nebuchadnezzar, who brought him in the first place and with whom he had some relationship. And then Nebuchadnezzar's son, and then Belshazzar is the third. And basically, they've all forgotten Daniel. As much as he's helped the kingdom, they have neglected him and forgotten him. So in verse 17, we have Daniel telling the king Let thy gifts be to thyself and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, actually grandfather, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave them, all people, nations, languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew. Whom he would, he kept alive. And whom he would, he set up. And whom he would, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. He was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was like the wild asses, and they fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointeth over it whomsoever he will. And thou, his son, actually grandson, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all of this. Daniel rebukes them. How dare you neglect the lesson from God that was brought to your family not so long ago? How dare you neglect that? You knew these things. And so in the prophecy, Daniel actually has a rebuke of Belshazzar. And by the way, Belshazzar was not even aware of Daniel. Apparently, Daniel is the farthest thing from his mind. The queen mother in verse 11 of chapter 5, the queen mother, as I described in your notes, that's there. This would be Nabonidus's wife. That's the middle king. Nebuchadnezzar's daughter and Belshazzar's mother, the same person. She, in verse 11, had to say, there is a man in thy kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. So the queen mother has to tell Belshazzar that Daniel exists and that he's able to do this. They have no idea who Daniel is. What a terrible thing just to be forgotten after all that Daniel had done for this king, for this kingdom, to be absolutely forgotten as an old man. What a terrible thing. But that's the way it was. Daniel is offered because he gives the meaning of the handwriting on the wall, which is essentially the kingdom is going to be snatched away from you this very night. The king offers Daniel a reward. Daniel says, no, thank you. And it really doesn't matter because that king is no longer on the throne by morning. It's over. And that brings us to 538, where you have the kingdom falling to Darius the Mede. Well, one more time, while Darius the Mede is in power, you have Daniel betrayed as an old man. So we skip from his young years to his older years. And in Daniel chapter 6, you have the story of Daniel and the lion's den. Remember how it goes. Out of jealousy, the other deputies of the Medo-Persian king Darius hatched a plot to entrap the 80-year-old Daniel in a capital crime. So we have verses 4 through 9 of chapter 6. Do you remember how they said, then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion or fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. He's just a man of integrity. That's how he is. Verse 5, then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. So they brought the idea to the king, remembering that all ancient pagan kings took themselves to be gods. And so it was a natural thing that these fellows could say, how about if all prayers from now on are addressed to you because you're a god and you're a god here in Babylon. So how about if all prayers are addressed to you? This flatters the king and he goes for it, as you know. But that will never work with Daniel. So if you look in your notes again, about halfway down, knowing Daniel's integrity, verses 4 and 10, the deputies could count on Daniel to pray to his God in defiance of the king's new law. And that's the way it turned out in verse 10. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, you're not allowed to pray to anybody but the king. He knew that the writing was signed. He went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did before time. Same thing. It's so interesting. I've given you the text there in 1 Kings 8:33. When Solomon was praying about the dedication of the temple in Jerusalem, he said, "Lord, if ever the people are carried away captive, if they pray toward this house, hear them." That's what Daniel is doing. He's praying toward Jerusalem, just like Solomon said in his dedication prayer. In the 55th Psalm, we have the idea of praying in the morning, at noon, and at night, 3 times a day. And that's exactly what Daniel was doing, praying toward Jerusalem 3 times a day, just like the 55th Psalm. Against Darius' wishes and regrets, verses 18 through 20, Daniel was arrested, moved to a pit into which lions were released. The lions, however, were tamed by an angel in the presence of Daniel. In the face of divine intervention, the king promoted Daniel, executed the deputies who schemed against him, and made a decree in favor of Daniel's God. And you know the story very well. The great part of that, again, not only the rescue, I mean, that's pretty great, but Daniel really stuck to his guns. And when he knew that the order had been signed, it didn't change one thing. It was the same when he was a kid as when he was an old man. And he is an old man by the time this is going on. Daniel must be 80 years old, maybe even more than that. And so sometimes you imagine young Daniel in the lion's den. He was 80-year-old Daniel in the lion's den. But nevertheless, when he was a kid, he put his life in his hands. And when he was an old man, he put his life in his hands. He just didn't care about life. He cared about God, which is so great. Now, if you turn that page over, you're going to see that there are these several instances that I wanted to draw your attention to when Daniel was visited by Jesus and visited by angels in answer to prayer, which is very fun to talk about. It's very interesting to us. And all of this is taking place, especially in chapters 9 through 12. So let me just give you a taste of this. And then I want to spend most of the time on the verses that I prepared for you at the bottom of this page. When Daniel, as you see there in the top under that heading, Daniel visited by Jesus and by angels. When Daniel prayed for information about the return of Israeli captivities to the Holy Land, Gabriel visited him with a message from God, including the famous prophecy of the 70 weeks. So if you look at chapter 9, you can see that Daniel is going to pray for help because he realizes that 70 years have actually gone by. The prophet Jeremiah said you're going to be in captivity for 70 years. So you do the arithmetic. Okay, so I came here in 606, let's say, maybe 605, but let's say 606. I came here to Babylon in 606. I'm now in the year about 536. That's 70 years. And Jeremiah said it would be a 70-year captivity. So where do we stand? Are we close to the end? Is this what Jeremiah was talking about? And so we have the calculation of the 70 years. We must be there. In verses 20 through 23, after Daniel's been praying for this wisdom, we say, "While I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, Jerusalem, yea, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening sacrifice, and he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give you skill and understanding, and now will come the 70 weeks prophecy." So that's such a great thing that he got to meet Gabriel on more than one occasion, as it turns out. 4 years later, after Daniel had fasted and prayed, this is in chapter 10, after Daniel had fasted and prayed, he actually met Jesus. Now, the text does not say that this is the Son of God, but every indication is that he is the Son of God. If you look at chapter 10, verses 5 to 9, Daniel again is praying and fasting. He said, "Then I lift up my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz. His body also was like the barrel." So you're getting a picture that's very similar to Revelation chapter 1. His body also, in verse 6, like the barrel, his face as the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as lamps of fire. That's just like Revelation 1. And his arms and his feet like in color to polish brass. Feet in Revelation chapter 1 are like brass. And the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude. And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision. For the men that were with me saw not the vision, but a great quaking fell upon them, so that they fled to hide themselves. And therefore I was left alone. I saw this great vision, and there remained no strength in me, for my comeliness was turned in me into corruption, and I retained no strength. And down he fell. He met, evidently, the Son of God. It sounds just like Revelation chapter 1. Well, so he fainted. And when he came back to consciousness, which happened because he was touched by an angel, maybe Gabriel again, the angel gave him a message about spiritual warfare, chapter 10, verses 10 through 21, which someday we'll talk about, not today, but that was amazing. And that message caused Daniel to become mute. Now he can't speak. He can't say anything. And it also caused him to have yet another near fainting spell. It doesn't look like he went completely unconscious, but he had no strength. And then the angel assisted him two more times to get through this encounter. And then we have the explanation that we find in Daniel chapter 11 and the opening of chapter 12. Following this information in chapter 12, two more angels appeared to Daniel and encouraged him as an elderly man, well into his 80s by then, to remain steadfast. So Daniel has all of these very interesting experiences with angels and even with the Son of God himself. So here's what I want to talk about for a few minutes now. How did all this affect Daniel? Made a profound impression on him to be in the presence of God and to have these dreams and visions and revelations from God. And we forget sometimes how big God is, how we are going to feel someday when we're in the presence of God. And Daniel is so good to describe this to us. In chapter 2, remember, this is the vision where there is the image of Nebuchadnezzar, and nobody understands the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And so Daniel is given the revelation, the interpretation about what the dream is and what it means. And you'll notice this fills him with joy. When God tells him the answer to his prayer, verse 19 says, then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. He said, I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, and hast made known unto me what we desired of thee, for thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. I thank thee and praise thee. So this is just joy. And remember, he's just a kid. He's a teenager. Thank you for giving us the answer to our prayer. And so this just was so encouraging to Daniel. And we have to remember that the Lord wants to be in a relationship with us that would cause us to return thanks and praise to him. We should be like Daniel in our praises. But that's not all. In chapter 4, verse 19, chapter 4 is the tree vision. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour when the Lord revealed to him, the king said the vision, and the Lord revealed to him the meaning of the vision. It says Daniel was astonished for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. The king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies. I hate even to tell you what this dream is about. It was about Nebuchadnezzar losing his mind for 7 years. He hated even to say it. But isn't that interesting that in the presence of God and information about judgment, he was astonished for 1 hour and didn't really say anything, and his thoughts troubled him. You realize, of course, that that might be somewhat parallel to where we are right now. If we understood the judgments of God that are very likely to be unleashed in a very short period of time, we would be astonished. It is so easy for us to take God for granted, and God should not be taken for granted. It is so easy for us to go on the internet and look at bad pictures. That would be taking God for granted. It is so easy for us to get ill with people and say bad things to them. That's taking God for granted. It's so easy for us to lay out of church and worship. That's taking God for granted. But when you understand who God is and what His judgments are on the world, it's astonishing. I mean, really, is that what happens to a nation that takes God for granted? Is that what happens to a marriage in which the spouses have taken God for granted? Is that what happens in a young person's life when he takes God for granted? If we could get a glimpse of it like Daniel did, it would astonish us. We would sit quietly and be troubled for a long time. I think it's important to sit quietly and be troubled. Not that you should be a worrywart, but that you should be somber. You see, all of those qualifications for deacons and elders in the New Testament, it always says that they should be grave. And I don't want to be grave. That sounds boring. Grave, gravity, gravitas. This is an important thing that God is doing in the world. There should be a time to sit, to be quiet, to be astonished in the presence of God. I was reading about somebody recently who had some loss in his life, and they said he just about wore out his porch swing. He still did lots of great things, but he was sitting quietly. There was so much to think about. Sitting and being astonished in the presence of the Lord. If you knew what the Lord had in mind, you'd be astonished. So there's the praise. We praise and thank you, Lord. That was incredible. There's the astonishment. I'm troubled. I'm astonished. I really don't know what to say. Chapter 7. This is the vision of the four beasts. And the beasts are troubling. And so chapter 7, verse 15 says, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. In verse 28, hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations, my thoughts much troubled me, and my countenance, my appearance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. Again, this is a judgment the Lord was showing what was going to happen in world history, the history of wars, the rising and falling of nations and empires, and the end of it all with the return of Jesus. And Daniel said, as for me, my thoughts troubled me. My appearance changed. I realized that God is not to be taken for granted, that God is not to be neglected. This is a serious world. There is gravitas in this God, in this plan of God, and I should recognize it. In chapter 8, you have the same idea. Chapter 8 is the vision about the rise of the Greek Empire, Alexander the Great, and how that would affect the Persian Empire, in which Daniel now lived because Cyrus the Persian was in power, not Nebuchadnezzar the Babylonian. So Persia had risen, Babylon had fallen. And after Persia comes Greece, the Greek Empire. And when Daniel understood what the Lord was going to do in these wars, the rise and fall of nations, here's what he said, verse 26. And the vision of the evening and the morning, which was told, is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. He was sick for certain days. Once again, to Daniel, who was so brave, as a kid brave, as the elderly man in the lion's den brave, Daniel, who was so brave, was completely colored, completely changed by these visions of God, in which he understood that God is not the kid next door. He is not to be neglected. He is not to be carelessly spoken to or carelessly interfaced with. God is a wonderful God, but he is a dreadful God. He's a God who intervenes in the affairs of men, sometimes in judgment. And that made him sick. I was sick for certain days. Do you realize that if we knew what the Lord was going to do in the lives of certain people around us, some of these very close to us, we would be sick about it, just sick about it. And that is very different from the brand of Christianity that says, it really doesn't matter. You want to live with your boyfriend or girlfriend without getting married? That'll be all right. God's not going to do anything. You want to go party on Friday night and get a little liquored up? That's fine. God's not going to do anything. You want to use God's name in vain? That's fine. He never does anything. You think that you can just neglect your spiritual life? No great risk. That is not true. That is not true. Leaders in our orbit are saying things like, maybe everybody gets to go to heaven. Nobody has to go to hell. Maybe God's love is so great that it overwhelms all sin and all opposition, and love wins after all, and there's nothing to worry about. Daniel was sick for days after seeing what the Lord was going to do. It sounds like there's something to worry about. In chapter 10, this is where we are talking about that spiritual warfare and the time when Daniel met the Son of God and then also had interaction with angels. And notice again how much gravity, how intense this is. In verse 7, and I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men that were with me saw not the vision. They didn't even see anything, but a great quaking fell on them. They didn't even see anything. And yet the mood was such that they began to tremble. And they fled to hide themselves. Again, they didn't see anything, but the sense of it was such that they ran away and hid. Verse 8, therefore I was left alone and I saw this great vision, and there remained no strength in me, for my comeliness, my fitness was turned into corruption. I couldn't even stand. I had no strength. And I retained no strength. Verse 9, yet I heard the voice of his words. And when I heard the voice of his words, then was I in a deep sleep on my face, and my face toward the ground. That's having seen the Son of God. You're going to see the Son of God someday, and you're probably going to feel about like that. In the next section, verse 10, behold, a hand touched me, and this isn't going to be the hand of the Son of God. Evidently, this is going to be an angel's hand. And behold, a hand touched me, which set me on my knees upon the palms of my hands. So he's feeling better, but he's still on his hands and knees. And he said unto me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved. That's what Gabriel said to him once in chapter 9. That's why we think this is Gabriel. It's the same greeting. O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto thee and stand upright. For unto thee am I now sent. And when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood trembling. So he's still not doing real well. At least he's on his feet now instead of his hands and knees. But he's still trembling. Verse 12, then said unto me, fear not, Daniel. For from the first day that thou didst set thine heart to understand, to chasten thyself before thy God, thy words were heard. And I am come for thy words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 1 and 20 days, 21 days, 3 weeks. Daniel's been praying and asking the Lord for some instruction for 3 weeks. And the angel was sent as soon as he prayed, 3 weeks earlier. But it took time to break through because of the spiritual angelic warfare that was taking place. So in verse 13, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 1 and 20 days. But lo, Michael, another angel, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. Verse 14, now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. And when he had spoken such words unto me, I set my face toward the ground, and I became dumb. Once again, mute. He can't say anything. Verse 16, behold, one like the similitude of the sons of men, another angel, touched my lips, and I opened my mouth and spoke. So I've had help, now I can speak. I couldn't speak, now I can speak, because an angel helped me. And said unto him that stood before me, O my Lord, by the vision my sorrows are turned upon me, and I have retained no strength. I feel sick about what's happening here. I can hardly collect myself. I don't know what to say. I feel like I'm going to faint. And so in verse 17, for how can the servant of this my Lord talk with this my Lord? As for me, straightway there remain no strength in me, neither is there breath left in me. Literally, breathless in the presence of an angel who is revealing the future to him. Verse 18, then there came again and touched me one like the appearance of men, and he strengthened me. This is the second time an angel had to come just to keep him from falling over faint. And then in verse 19, he said, O man, greatly beloved, fear not. Peace be unto thee, be strong, yea, be strong. And when he had spoken unto me, I was strengthened and said, let my Lord speak, for thou hast strengthened me. So God is a God who makes you sick. God is a God who makes you tremble. Even if you're a great person, if you are the best of the best, if you're Daniel, God is a God who makes you sick. God is a God who makes you tremble. God is a God who takes your breath away. And for us to treat God with disrespect is such a huge mistake in life. It is the basis of every mistake in life, to disrespect God. If God is like Daniel says he is, and who knows better than Daniel, then from this day forward, we should respect him so carefully. We should walk in such a way as to please him and not invite any of the chastening judgments of God. Because a God who is this big and this scary, I don't want him to have to punish me, to chasten me, to set me straight. I don't want him putting his finger on my finances to straighten me out. I don't want him putting his finger on my children to straighten me out. I don't want him putting his finger on my health to straighten me out. I'd rather just be sweet and compliant and tame and give him the honor that he deserves. And it's not to say that God will never do pruning on our finances, on our health, on our loved ones. We like to say, pruned if you do and pruned if you don't, right? Even if you're doing well, the Lord is going to prune you and make you better. But let it be, he's pruning me because I'm Daniel and not because I was Jonah, disobedient, unfaithful. One kind of pruning I can live with. The other kind I would hate myself for. And you have the choice. Dare to be a Daniel.